This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. Istanbul takes food seriously, very seriously. And meyhane restaurants are where it all comes to life. These traditional establishments are all about community, shared plates, loud conversations, and ruckus served as part of the ritual. But take a small detour and the food starts doing something different. As innovators in the kitchen, like Chef Deniz, continue to rewrite the menu.
In Istanbul, new young chefs like me develop the Turkish cuisine, but we don't replace tradition. We give it new life.
Because in Istanbul, food never stands still.
Old flavors, new ideas.
It evolves. Slowly, confidently, one plate at a time. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parris. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room, 28 minutes in which you and I get the top experts to explain a big issue of the day. This week, energy prices are shooting up, energy companies are going bust. Why? And what does it tell us about the big new buzzword, our resilience? By breakfast this morning, two more energy suppliers had gone bust. Avro Energy and Green had 830,000 customers and therefore probably supplied the energy needs of 2 million people. They're just the latest and they won't be the last. Wholesale gas prices have shot up, catching these companies cold, and if prices stay up and we get a freezing winter, then that chill could spread. So why has this happened? What's going to happen next? And what does it tell us about Britain's energy supply and infrastructure? Step into the briefing room. Together we'll find out. The Business and Energy Secretary, Kwasi Kwarteng, told the House of Commons this week that the UK wasn't suffering a supply issue, but a pricing one. That would suggest this is a nasty blip, pricing being a shorter-term issue than supply. But is that what's happening? And what's the bigger picture? First, let's explore the immediate reasons for the crisis. Here's a report from the Briefing Room's John Murphy.
A massive rise in the wholesale costs paid by energy firms raises fears about a winter crisis.
There is absolutely no question, Mr. Speaker, of the lights going out or people being unable to heat their homes.
We need to learn longer-term lessons from this crisis about the resilience of our energy system and the lack of resilience, which has contributed to very large price spikes.
Many in the industry are talking about a perfect storm of events which have led to these incredibly sharp rises in gas prices.
David Shepherd is the energy editor at the Financial Times. I've been talking to him about some of the events that have created that perfect storm. Let's start with reliance.
The UK as an economy is incredibly reliant on natural gas, part of our legacy of having the North Sea fields, bringing gas ashore and heating homes, replacing coal on the grid so that we can generate electricity too.
One problem is that those North Sea gas fields are running out. There isn't much left, but we still need natural gas.
Let's put some figures on that about our reliance on gas. I mean, how reliant are we on gas?
Come the winter, almost 90% of all houses and flats in the UK are heated by natural gas. But we're also very reliant on it for electricity. At peak times for demand, more than 50% of all of the UK's electricity can be generated by burning natural gas, which spins the turbines, which produce the electricity, which we use for everything from charging electric cars to watching television and listening to the radio.
In recent years, the UK has made massive strides in generating more of our energy needs, by that I mean electricity, from renewables like wind and solar. Last year, a record 43% of electricity came from renewables, partly thanks to reduced demand during lockdown. That's good for reducing our greenhouse gas emissions.
As we've increased our reliance on renewables, we have shut down other power stations, such as coal plants. That means that when renewables can't work for whatever reason, such as the wind not blowing, the sun not shining, and over the summer we have seen a period of remarkably still weather, which has cut wind generation, that means we're even more reliant than some other countries on natural gas to keep the lights on. Right now, there's also more maintenance happening throughout the gas industry, partly as a legacy of the lockdowns that we saw at the start of the coronavirus pandemic last year. There were concerns about sending infected individuals to platforms to carry out additional work. That means we've got 2 years' worth of maintenance happening at once right now. As a result, the UK's own gas production has fallen by almost a quarter in 2021.
Then, last week, you might have heard of a fire in Kent which shut down a power cable linking us to France. That won't be operational again for some months.
John, if you could just explain something to me, why is that so important?
Well, let me first tell you what an interconnector is. It's a high-voltage cable connection to neighbouring countries. And bear with me, right now we have four of them linking us with mainland Europe, two to France, one to Belgium, and one to the Netherlands. Another one should be opening to Norway in October. We tend to be a net importer of electricity through those. There are two connections to Ireland, and we export a bit through them. That French one, which is out of action at the moment, had enough capacity to power 2 million homes, so losing it isn't very helpful. Another key thing to understand in this story, according to David Shepherd of the FT, is that the gas market involving gas going through pipelines is changing.
Increasingly, we're also starting to see gas move on ships in the liquefied natural gas market, when gas is super chilled, loaded onto a vessel, and then shipped around the world. That's had the effect of connecting gas markets up and putting different countries into competition with each other. That means when gas demand in Asia rises quickly, we can see knock-on effects in the UK or in wider Europe that we would not have seen in years past.
Economies restarting after lockdown, countries replenishing their gas supplies after a cold winter, and even pressure from Western governments to switch away from highly polluting coal power generation all mean Asia's demand for liquefied natural gas, or LNG, has gone up substantially.
The flip side of that is that it's increased competition for supplies, and many Asian countries have their energy companies are backed by the state and are willing to pay pretty much whatever it takes to secure the supplies of LNG that they want. In 2019, for example, the UK relied on LNG imports for almost a fifth of its total gas supplies. This year, the volume is far, far lower because most of the gas that comes on ships has instead been diverting towards higher priced markets in Asia, such as Japan, South Korea and China.
That was David Shepherd from the Financial Times with our own John Murphy. Kwasi Kwarteng also said this week that the current crisis underscores the need for a strong, homegrown, renewable energy sector. So how might we achieve that goal? And why aren't we there already? Dr. Sharon George is Senior Lecturer in Environmental Science at the University of Kiel. Sharon George, can you sum up for us how much renewable energy we can rely on in Britain right now?
Right now, we're only producing around about 40% and it fluctuates. We could go higher. It's risen relatively recently and we're producing good renewable energy from wind at the moment. There's been great advances in that and in solar. but there is room for more renewables that we could tap into. The UK is an island. We have some of the highest tidal ranges in the world. You know, we've got the second highest tidal range, 14 metres, second only to like Canada. And we have that right on our shores. And we had a plan to do the Severn Barrage, which would have provided, you know, up to 5 to 6% of our energy needs, but we didn't go with that. We've also got hydrogen that we could tap into for storage to make the renewables that we have, make more of them, and balancing out some of the peaks and troughs that you can see with renewable energy.
How fast could we increase the amount of renewable energy that we produce?
Some renewable energies are quite quick to do. So solar, we've got masses of farmland that could be put to productive use through solar farms. And that's relatively quick to do. Even wind turbines, once compared to, say, a nuclear power station that takes almost a decade. Some of the things like the tidal barrage, that again can take, you know, around about a decade. But if we want to go big and really make a difference, we need to really get on with this.
Can I just ask you a question about self-sufficiency and resilience? We get these words used quite a lot. Are they the same thing?
No. When we talk about self-sufficiency, it's kind of the ability to produce what we need within our own shores. Resilience is more about being prepared for those shocks, those unexpected things. So that can come from climate change, as we've seen with sort of weather conditions and a reduction in wind energy production. And it can come from things like fire on the major power line. So resilience is more about making sure that our systems are able to absorb those big shocks and unexpected events.
Where would you put your emphasis, on resilience or self-sufficiency?
The two things go hand in hand. If you are building in resilience, I would say that self-sufficiency is part of that. Right now, our resilience isn't really very good. We import a lot of gas, we import a lot of fossil fuels to prop up our energy mix. The more we can produce our own energy through solar, through wind, and also through storage. We're not great at storage, and that's something that we could really fix.
When we talk about storage, what do we mean?
At the moment, when gas comes into the UK, there's only so much storage that we have of that gas to deal with those fluctuations in demand. And, you know, sometimes in the UK, that can be down to a matter of weeks or even days. So at the moment, we do have some storage. We have a big storage facility at Dunorwig that pumps water to the top of the mountain in Wales. And when, you know, the price of electricity is low, the water gets pumped up. And when we need that energy, we can very quickly release that. That was built years ago. We haven't really done any massive storage on that scale since then. So we need to think about this. And one of the solutions that we could look at is hydrogen, which is an absolutely fantastic energy carrier. You burn it, it doesn't produce CO2. But at the moment, there's not that many places making hydrogen. People talk about grey hydrogen produced from fossil fuels, but we need to be moving towards green hydrogen. And actually, at the moment, that's quite expensive. Where hydrogen can really make a big contribution is where we have renewables. We can then use that spillover energy when we have an excess of energy. We can then produce hydrogen, store it in tanks, and that can then be used for transport. We can use it later in heating.
Do we have currently the technology that we would need in order to create the storage to go entirely renewable?
At the moment, no. We need to really ramp this up. So we need to think about energy holistically. We need to think about it right from when we produce the energy at the wind turbine or the solar panel all the way through to the consumer, whether that's somebody turning a light switch on in a house or a ceramics manufacturer turning on a kiln. And that whole infrastructure, that whole use needs to be thought out, especially when we're looking at things like distributed generation and rural use as well.
It's very interesting. You painted a picture of things that we partially have in place, things that we don't have in place at all, things that would take a short period of time to do and things that would take a long period of time to do. Now, in the interim, Is gas going to remain an important part of any transition?
It is going to remain a bridge for a while. The sooner we can get off gas, the better. But it's not going to be an overnight fix. Really, we ought to have been on this sooner, but it is complicated and a lot of the solutions are expensive.
Sharon George, are we alone in this, or are other Western European countries facing the same difficulties as us? Michael Bradshaw is Professor of Global Energy at the Warwick Business School and co-director of the UK Energy Research Centre. Michael Bradshaw, we've been talking about the problems here in the UK. What's been going on elsewhere? I'm thinking particularly of our nearest neighbours.
This is a global problem. I think the bottom line at the moment is there's no really cheap gas anywhere. I suspect in France, it's less of an immediate concern because their electricity system is not as much based on natural gas. It's that there's a high degree of reliance on nuclear power. I think in Germany, there's been an ongoing discussion about the role of gas. And part of the problem in Germany is that this is also having a knock-on effect into electricity generation and coal prices because the carbon price in Europe is very high. And that is making it difficult to use coal.
Do the European countries do something that we don't do? For example, do they have more storage?
Significantly more storage. If you were to look at the bigger markets, you know, Germany and Italy, for example, well above 20, possibly 30% of their annual demand. And in the UK, for various reasons, it's 1% to 2% at most.
That's a gigantic difference.
Absolutely. There are historical reasons for that. First and foremost is that when we had the North Sea producing lots of gas, we simply turned the tap up and more gas flowed into the UK, and therefore we didn't build any storage. We did then have storage, particularly in the Rough gas field in the North Sea, a depleted gas field owned by Centrica. But back in 2017, they announced that was going to close.
Now, let's talk about the supply of gas. Russia dominates the European gas market. What can we say about its reliability as a supplier?
Historically, Russia and before it the Soviet Union have been very reliable suppliers of gas to Northwest Europe, although there have been issues with particularly the Baltic states and, of course, more notoriously with Ukraine over and on a number of occasions creating gas security issues. But generally, they have been a reliable supplier because this trade matters to them. It's a large part of Gazprom's income.
So in other words, it's just not been in their interest to play footsie with us over gas because we would all look elsewhere. So they want our custom and they've been reliable.
Yes, there was a big debate when the United States started to produce liquefied natural gas and talked about exporting it to Europe as to how Gazprom would respond. And Gazprom has also been a bit bruised by the way the European Commission has treated them in terms of the way that gas is priced and traded in Europe. And maybe they have a point to prove, as one Russian commentator put it, that they're not showing goodwill at the moment.
Michael, what does not expressing goodwill mean in practice?
Well, normally when there's a gas emergency like this, countries and companies tend to help each other out and Russia would flow more gas. Of course, one needs to wonder, you know, is more gas not coming because they don't want to do it or because they've got reasons for not doing it? And it's difficult to determine which. It is possible that they could be doing more in terms of flowing gas and then they decided not to. But it's a dangerous game to play, I would say, because already the image of gas in Europe is tarnished. And all this is going to do is give greater credence to those who say, well, the answer, of course, is to move away from gas and to be less reliant on the likes of Russia.
Does it make sense to look at alternatives to Russian gas?
Much as the UK government says we've got a diversity of supply, I mean, Europe does have alternatives, not least of which, of course, domestic production. So, I mean, Norway is particularly important. The problem is that the Netherlands and the UK, both traditional suppliers, are both experiencing declines in production. And because of the earthquake problems they've had in the Groningen field, Dutch gas is falling very, very rapidly. So the domestic supply is falling. There are pipelines from North Africa, from Algeria, and a new pipeline coming in from Azerbaijan, but they're not moving huge volumes. And then there was the hope that Europe could rely on more liquefied natural gas coming from, you know, traditionally from Qatar, but more recently from places like the United States and actually also Russia.
Is energy supply something that the European Union has a significant degree of activity over? And if it is it something we're missing out on influencing?
Well, the rules of trade in Europe are determined by the European Union, and it's a very complicated rule book that influences the way in which we trade. And actually, we've inherited that rule book as a consequence of Brexit.
So Brexit, per se, won't be having any impact on our capacity to make decisions in this field?
Not yet. There are three areas to think about in terms of Brexit. One is that, you know, that rule book I talked about, which we not only inherited, we're still implementing. But of course, we will review that rule book and may make changes in the future. And that may cause issues if we diverge from the way that they do things in Europe. I think the second issue is what they call a solidarity mechanism, which suggests that if there are gas emergencies in Europe, the EU member states should help their neighbours out. We're not an EU member anymore. So what might happen this winter if there was a physical security issue is uncertain. I guess our insurance policy is really that the Republic of Ireland gets all its gas from the UK, or the vast majority of it. And therefore, if they were to shut off gas to the UK, they'd be effectively shutting off supply to Ireland, an EU member state. And a third issue is that we're actually beholden to what happens in terms of EU energy diplomacy and relations between Brussels and Moscow, because although we don't get a lot of gas from Russia directly, the price of gas in Northwest Europe influences what we pay for our gas in the UK.
Okay, so it's a case study in interdependency. Let's imagine for a moment that I am the Secretary of State for Energy. Could you give me your thoughts on what could happen if there is a harsh winter in the UK?
At the moment, if you look around the global gas market, prices are high everywhere. And if you look at the futures market, what the industry is saying you need to pay to bring gas in the next 2 or 3, 4 months, there's no sign of the price going down. The government's been very confident that we can attract the gas we need. I'm not as confident, and I think we do need to look at measures in terms of what might happen in terms of short-term emergencies, particularly managing on the demand side in terms of trying to manage down supply in certain sectors to protect consumers and so forth. And the fact that we've got no storage really to rely on means that, you know, we have to hope that gas continues to flow from the normal sources, which would include for continental Europe. If it's a cold winter, it's a cold winter across Europe. Sometimes a cold winter, a blocking high in Europe, means no wind power either. So we've got to hope we don't have a cold winter, keep our fingers crossed, and maybe perhaps Gazprom and the Kremlin will start to supply more gas.
Michael Bradshaw. Finally, let's go big picture. I'm joined now in the briefing room by Sir Dieter Helm, Professor of Economic Policy at the University of Oxford and Fellow in Economics at New College, Oxford. He's advised European governments and in 2017 carried out the cost of energy review for the British government. Dieter Helm, if we step back a moment from the immediate sense of crisis, what is the bigger, longer-term picture we should be seeing here?
We've been on a path for the last 30 years since privatisation, resting on the belief that energy, particularly electricity and gas, are just commodities like any other. There's nothing special about them. And that what we should do is expose these sectors to the maximum competition. And whatever the costs happen to be at any point in time, that's what consumers should pay. And what that misses is the fundamental point about energy, which is that it's one of those core parts of what it takes to be a citizen and participate in society and for the economy to function. And it requires long-term thinking in a world which we've created of short-term trading markets, etc.
Now, of course, what a government might respond to that is by saying, yes, but we put a price cap on the energy. Now, I suspect that what you're talking about in terms of the market are the longer-term questions about energy provision.
Yes, we have a price cap. And when I did the cost of energy review for the government, I looked at the margins that the supply businesses were then making, and they were really mouthwateringly large. So they're absolutely right that we should have a price cap. There is an ability to pay, and that's the limit of it. But we need to look beyond that. What is it we need to put in place to make sure that we have reliable, secure energy, which people can afford to pay and is on a path towards decarbonisation? And short-term spot markets don't solve those problems.
Now, I want to ask you, in the bigger sense, was this crisis predictable? In other words, was something like this going to come along at some point and show us that we didn't really have the resilience to deal with it?
In energy markets, there are always price spikes. There are always events that happen. Sometimes they're on a colossal scale, like the great OPEC oil shocks of the 1970s, which literally changed the world's economies for the following decade. And sometimes they're just spikes now and then. So nobody should be surprised there's a spike. This is a bit bigger, but there are particular reasons why it's a bit bigger. What matters is that you have an energy system which has enough storage capacity, resilience to withstand those. And what's become absolutely apparent, and some of us have been saying it for some time, is that's exactly what we don't have.
How much of this is about our unwillingness to pay more for new energy sources?
It's pretty clear that there's a reluctance to face up to the true costs of decarbonisation. But you can hardly blame the public when politicians run round, and indeed serious commentators run round, and tell us it's all going to be virtually free, perhaps 1% of GDP. And know why they do that. They want to get the public on side to address climate change. But if you don't tell people that they are currently living beyond their sustainable means, that they're going to have to adjust to paying for the pollution that they're causing through their consumption, that therefore the bills will be higher, you're not exactly going to create the environment in which, when the bills turn out to be higher, the public turns around and says, oh, I thought you told us something different, but hey, it doesn't matter, we'll go on paying. Well, they can't pay, they're not in a position to pay, and they didn't expect to pay, and now it's a shock. And that's politically extremely dangerous for those like me who really care about climate change.
Well, how do you think we should pay for the transition to green energy?
Well, the first thing to say is that you need to do it efficiently. So if you're going to have, and I think it's inevitable and desirable, lots and lots of small-scale renewables on the system, wind farms, solar panels and so on, things which only work, you know, when the sun shines and when the wind blows, etc., then you have to design a system which is capable of dealing with the consequences of when the wind doesn't blow. And that means you have to have robust storage. And that's precisely what we don't do. You know, our storage is minimal when it comes to gas. And it's all very well to say, oh, we're just going to disinvest from gas, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact is, the only way we're going to get through this decade and back up that intermittency is, for example, through gas. You have to make decisions about whether you're going to have nuclear power stations or not.
To what extent can citizens be safeguarded against the long-term additional costs by insulation? Well, and I say this partially because there are people lying across the M25 suggesting that this is the answer.
Well, it's true that energy efficiency is generally a good thing. But it's not true that energy efficiency necessarily leads to people spending less on energy or using less energy. Quite the contrary. We've been having increasing energy efficiency really quite remarkably since the 1970s, and demand has gone up, not down. Because in the end, what people buy in energy terms, the degree of comfort they have in their house, the weather in the longer term they add air conditioning to it as well, is a function of what the total bill is and what they can afford to pay for.
OK, I'm Kwasi Kwarteng. I ask you in and I say, not only do I want to prevent what might be coming this winter, but I also want to lay a better system in store for my successors. What should I do, Dieter?
You need to start by addressing the intermittency issue, by which I mean the fact that you can't rely on 100% operations of a wind farm. And you need to make sure, in the first instance, that the gas is okay. That requires storage. Not, as the Secretary of State told the Select Committee, storage as a kind of red herring. You know, a tanker on the high seas is not a reliable source of gas. It can turn off course and go to China instead. We've closed down our storage. We need that resilience. You need the capacity to back that up. And then you need to make some pretty hard decisions. Hard decisions about what exactly supply competition is and what it takes for a supplier to meet reasonable conditions of prudence, financial integrity, and the ability to deliver on what they promised to deliver. And that requires long-term contracts. We have to move away from the spot market determining everything to putting in place a long-term framework of contracts so we have a stability of costs. Then stop faffing. Are you going to build a nuclear power station or not? Are you going to do the hydrogen and the CCS, carbon capture and storage, properly? Are you going to put the money up or not? How much wind are you going to auction in the contracts to be delivered? You know, these are the kinds of decisions. It's not rocket science. You know, we faffed around year after year after year. So time to put up and decide and put in place the central pillars of what our energy system will have to be and make sure that that's in place. And behind that, we have responsible players contracting so that you and I, as customers who are the least able to adjust to volatility, have a stability too.
Dieter Helm. Keynes, it seems, was wrong. It's because of what we do in the short term that we're all dead. My thanks to Dieter Helm, David Shepherd, Sharon George and Michael Bradshaw. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were John Murphy, Kirstine Knight and Soile Aparicio. The sound engineer was Graham Puddyfoot and the editor is Jasper Corbett. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Recently, we've explored vaccine passports and booster jabs, the ending of the pandemic uplift in universal credit, and whether tensions over Taiwan could lead to war.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.